I'm sitting in IPR Studio A today with composer Nico Muhly. Thank you for being with us here in Interlaken.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to talk to you about the piece So Far, So Good, which is a New York premiere. The kids are performing on June 5th at the Phil Biennial. But just tell me about it. Describe it for our audience who haven't had a chance to hear it yet.
So the piece is, essentially, it begins with a sort of chorale piece of information. It's these big sort of cluster chords in strings and brass. And then out of that emerges what I would call agitated information. And there's this kind of aggressive sort of Morse code thing that emerges from the bass trombone and the tenor drum. And all this kind of transforms into much more kinetic and precise dance-like music, but very, very light. And there's always this sense that everything's kind of going okay until something kind of goes wrong underneath it. So you'll be in an incredibly static harmonic universe, and suddenly there'll be sort of an antagonizing chord. And then it essentially turns into a drone study for a second, where you have just this one single A that is bounced around in the whole orchestra, around which all the other things happen. So you have the chorale information, you have the dance information, and then it kind of explodes at the end. It's a very simple piece, even though it's sort of long. It was more an experiment in using a minimum of harmonic material and seeing how I could unfold it in a dramatic way.
So Christopher Williams has created a dance called The Good So Far with it.
Yeah.
And did you guys talk at all about this, or has it been a completely separate?
We emailed about it in the vaguest of ways.
Okay. I love that.
But I think in general, you know, unless you're working hand in hand with a choreographer, it's better to let them carve their own path through a piece. Because in a lot of cases, working hand in hand means that you're really kind of brain meld, mind meld. But you know, in a sense, when you've written a piece of music that wasn't meant for dance, that's being danced too, you encourage the choreographer and indeed the dancers to make their own itinerary through it metrically and also emotionally. So it's almost better if I don't get involved.
I was just going to ask how it felt, because you have done dance commissions, plenty of them. Mm. In fact, I'm going to get the name wrong, but you work with somebody quite regularly.
Benjamin Milupier.
Thank you. So it's not like you're unfamiliar with this process. Does it feel weird to have a piece that you've written is it like a, you know, putting a child out there? You've put it out there and
That's always the metaphor people use. I mean, I don't have kids, so I don't really know.
I know, sorry.
But in a sense, I mean, it doesn't feel that different to me than having strangers play your orchestra music, which in a sense is like, you know, you write it for one band and then it goes somewhere else and then all of a sudden it has a life of its own.
So going back a little bit further, we were talking before the interview, friends, about choral music. And you were a chorister.
I was, yeah, in Providence, Rhode Island.
Right.
When I was a boy.
So, and then you also play piano. When you're composing, I mean, this is a thing for me, honestly, and it's a genuine question. Where does it come from? Like, what's the voice? Do you hear a sung voice in your hair? Do you hear a piano? Do you hear just a sound? What's the genesis?
Well, for me, actually, the prompt or the cue is non-musical. So it'll be a sentence, or it'll be a linguistic trick, or it'll be a sort of turn of phrase, or it'll be a painting, or it will be some. Usually for me, it comes from language, though. And so, in a sense, the mysterious part of the process is not where that comes from, because that's, you know, we're inundated with language and we're surrounded by language, and no matter what you do, you're sort of confronted with it. But then the question is, how do you take that and turn it into something musical? So for me, that's the gray area that's hard to define. But I think the fact that it's not musical helps me a lot, because it feels like I'm in a conversation with a different discipline. So in a lot of cases, you know, orchestral music will come from a shape in my head more so than, so it'll say, you know, here's a thing that comes back a couple of times, and each time it's prolonged, or each time it's shorter, or each time it's antagonized in a different way. So it's more non-musical in origin.
So I think many of us who don't compose, which is the majority of the world, right? Like, I can't even imagine having that creative ability. We sort of picture you walking the hills, you with a capital U, you know, walking the hills, communing with nature and now reading things and just sort of, you know, like a symphony comes to you.
Right.
Presumably that's not actually what happens.
No,
right?
And I find myself really actively resisting that model. I mean, that's the sort of Beethovenian, like, romantic model. Romantic, but not in the sense of, well, in addition to the sense of style, but also our version of how we think about art being made. And for me, going back to choral music, you know, I don't think anyone who wrote choral music before, you know, the 1900s thought about what they were doing as this kind of great heroic thing. I mean, in fact, you know, if you think about Bach as a good example, it's like there was, you know, there wasn't a time in his life when there wasn't a deadline, and not just one deadline, but like six deadlines in a week, right? So if you think about the cantatas, they were written very, very quickly. There was no time for reflection. What reflection there was sort of textual reflection on the nature of the text and how that text relates to the scripture for the week, right? So in a sense, you act as the composer acts as a precentor or acts as an interpreter of the scripture. And the composer also acts in the case of Bach, as someone who incorporates the congregation into the act of worship, right? So that's the sort of Lutheran model. But even I think if you're thinking about Tallis or Byrd, right, there's this sense of the composer being able to articulate something about whatever time of year it is that you can't do through scripture, right? So if you have, you know, if someone reads out the text of you know, from the Acts of the Apostles about Pentecost, that's great. But then if you actually have a motet that deals with that, right, with deals with the many tongues and deals with the ornamentation, that's the composer functioning not like a romantic in the woods, but functioning like a storyteller or someone who's really, really part of the community.
What do you think is the most you that you've written?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, we think that maybe music that's for hire, which in a sense is what a commission is somehow not as indicative of the composer's, you know, quote unquote personality as music that's written for pleasure. But I think in a weird way, for me specifically, and this is just how I'm wired, having something to rub up against makes a sharper edge. Where in a sense, you know, having a complicated commission, for me, I feel like I end up with a more interesting result. And again, something sharper and something that bears the trace of a certain amount of resistance, or of, you know, a long period of problem solving. You know, it feels like you've come home from the store with a bunch of ingredients and you think, okay, right, like I've got to just make this happen. Like it's not about kind of wandering around the woods and foraging. It's about kind of dealing with the reality of this thing. Going back to the things that are the most quote unquote me, I mean, I find that my sort of emotional sort of cellar level, sort of, you know, the basement of what I do is always choral music.
With Interlaken, with the Arts Academy Orchestra playing your piece, is this an age group you work with regularly?
It's not. I mean, I occasionally deal with college students, and then of course, you know, in the choral situation, and especially in the UK, you end up working with people who are sort of under 12. So high school is a sort of, there's something very special about someone sort of, you know, 14 or 15 confronting a piece of music for the first time. There's a passage in So Far So Good, you always have to kind of shed it as an ensemble, right? And it's tricky because the meter changes all the time and things that were accented become unaccented. And yesterday we had a rehearsal and it happened perfectly. Like, and not even like, oh, this is this hard thing we've worked on for a million years and this is why it's great and we're scared of you. It was like, this is just part of the vocabulary that we grew up with. And I think that's an amazing thing.
Well, Nico Muhly, thank you so much for spending time with us here at Classical IPR Studio A, Prelude to New York Phil. Now you're going to play a piece for us. Tell us what that's going to be.
I'm going to play a piece, an older one from about 10 years ago called A Hudson Cycle.